Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 66. Sometimes you just have to eat your own words. In one of the previous autopsy episodes, I had mentioned that I am a stickler for precision language, particularly regarding technical subjects. And yet, almost as quickly as I posted the last three episodes on the autopsy, I realized that I had gotten a few facts wrong. That happens here from time to time, and when it does happen, I try to correct it, at least if it's material. I got these matters wrong in my rush to get those episodes out to you as I dashed off on a 10-day trip. And these errors, I realized, were to some extent a result of not using precision language. I'll explain. First, when describing some of the bullet fragments in reference to the X-rays that were taken, I described the existence of radio-opaque materials along the side of President Kennedy's head. After I listened to that description, after that episode went live, I realized it sounded almost as if he had been shot with a shotgun and that I was describing perhaps buckshot that was embedded on the exterior of his head itself. What I was actually describing was the visual from the X-ray that was taken, which showed a path of those fragments inside the president's brain, not outside of his head. So for those of you who caught that, I'm sorry about that. Second, I also indicated that Dr. Humes had made the dot on the anatomical pad showing the spot in the shoulder where the bullet had pierced the president. It was actually Dr. Boswell that made that dot on the pad itself. I also got some of the facts mixed up on what parts of the autopsy documentation exactly were destroyed and when by Dr. Humes. As you know, he revised his autopsy report, and I was speaking to one of the details of that. I've got an episode coming up that focuses on, among other things, Humes. And in that one, I will elaborate on what I now believe to be the best understanding of what actually happened with the documentation. But we'll let that one rest on the floor for now. Oh, and one other thing. I believe I might have said that the only one of the three pathologists that had spoken to the Warren Commission was Dr. Humes, the lead pathologist. That is not true. Actually, Humes, Boswell, and Fink all spoke to the Warren Commission, and they spoke in other investigative venues as well. As I have mentioned before, though, Dr. Fink was the only one of the three good doctors to testify and be cross-examined at an actual trial. And, of course, the only trial on the topic was the Clay Shaw trial in New Orleans that was conducted by Jim Garrison. I have to admit, being inside the labyrinth of the medical autopsy creates a disorientation of the facts. At least for me, this is one of the more confusing areas of the assassination. In some ways, firsthand accounts were never allowed to be taken beyond the official documents and sworn testimony because everyone present at the autopsy that night or shortly thereafter was asked to sign an order of secrecy requiring them to say nothing to no one, for a period of 15 years, or face severe criminal charges and fines. It proved to be effective. And it also injected into the circumstance what inevitably happens when testimonials begin to appear some 15 years or more after the actual events, when things are, as we know, less fresh in everyone's mind. There are many recollections in this story about the night of the autopsy that are just plain in contravention with one another. All we can do now is listen to witness testimony or conversations and decide for ourselves what might be the truth. The House Select Committee on Assassinations was not the first investigative body to look into the autopsy material and its credibility as published by the Warren Commission. But, interestingly enough, their investigations came at just about the 15-year mark in 1978, just in time for the secrecy restrictions to run out, or in some cases, just before. depending on the exact date of the testimony taken. The HSCA investigation was the first investigation with a chance to run out the clock, so to speak, on those secrecy restrictions. You have to wonder how that figured in, at least to things that were said before time ran out under those secrecy clauses. A glimpse of that is heard in the sworn testimony of Second Lieutenant Richard Lipsey. He was a young officer, 24 years of age, who by incredible chance was picked out of a group of more than 200 officers that were up for the position and who ended up becoming an aide-de-camp to General Philip Wheel. When Wheel was transferred to Washington, Lipsey went with him. You've met General Philip Wheel in one of the previous autopsy episodes. Lipsey was asked to testify before the House Select Committee, and he himself asked the interrogators that question about the secrecy clause, whether it was still applicable and whether he was still under a government restriction despite being called to testify. And based on my math, it still was applicable at the time of his testimony. A 15-year expiration meant that time would have run out in late November 1978. His testimony was taken in January 1978, about 10 months prior to the expiration of the secrecy agreement. Listen to what Lipsey said on that topic. Lipsey turns out to be an interesting character in this act of the play. He was right there. He saw it all. So he says. Yet he was not in the inventory of individuals that were in the original Siebert and O'Neill FBI inventory of attendees. That does cast a bit of a shadow on the FBI report. That makes it difficult to believe that others might not have been there as well, others that were not documented in that Siebert and O'Neill report as being present at the autopsy. As you recall, the Siebert and O'Neill report is widely seen as containing the most comprehensive list of those present at the autopsy itself. On the other hand, maybe the Siebert and O'Neill inventory was accurate, and Lipsey's facts morphed a bit over the years. You'll hear him tell a story in his later years that he was no more than 6 or 8 feet away during most of the autopsy, basically a front row seat right in the autopsy room. And, he also says that there were very few people in the room. Listen to that in contrast to what was documented in the Siebert and O'Neill report. You know, interestingly enough, a newspaper story of Lipsey's account does seem to report other facts consistent with the rest of Lipsey's story that he tells today and that you will hear, with the exception of one thing. The newspaper story placed him up in the student gallery watching the autopsy from there. These discrepancies are indicative of so much that is the story of the JFK autopsy. Good men of good character stating what they believe to be facts that are in direct contravention with what other good men say. It's a recurring theme through this medical labyrinth.
Okay, this tape is now beginning. We are interviewing Richard A. Lipsey. The date is January 18th, 1978. The time is approximately 20 of 12. We're in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. It's time for the sporting goods store, place of business for Richard Lipsey. Also present, the staff members, Andrew Purdy, Donald A. Purdy, Jr., Mark Flanagan. Mr. Lipsey, you are consenting that you are being taped at this time?
That is correct.
Okay.
Now, let me ask you fellows a question. Before we start, and the only thing that I've questioned about this conversation is that, and I don't even remember, I don't have a copy of it, I can't tell you what it is, but right, as you know, I was the aide to General Wheel. And as such, we were responsible for all the funeral proceedings, arranging it. We did everything from getting the Irish Guard there on time to the whole bit. And I did watch the autopsy, or the majority of it. I wasn't there 100% of the time, but I watched most of it. Afterwards, about a week or so later, I can remember signing a document in our office that came under some kind of Federal Secrets Act and that we should not discuss any information. Take information and hold my calls. That we should not discuss anything of a secret nature that we felt was a secret nature, particularly anything about the autopsy, for a period of 15 years, I think it was. Now, are you excluded from this?
Well, it's our understanding that this is
not that I know, once again, not that I know anything, it makes a hell of a lot of difference. We were just told not to discuss it for, and I don't remember whether it was 15 years or 20 years, but I definitely remember signing something of that nature.
Well, it's our position that we are pursuing this investigation, pursuant to the mandate of Congress, and that we hope that you will wish to participate and to give us the information in a voluntary manner.
Fine. No question about it. As long as you feel that in your position with Congress, that anything I may have signed would be null and void as far as you're concerned.
Well, we are not in a position to give you legal advice as to what you should or should not do.
Yeah.
It is our position that there will not be any harm coming to you from cooperating with our investigation because of what you tell us. If there is something
I don't think there is. I think the point of it was obviously to, until the investigation this time, this was, you know, the investigation hadn't even started, was it really that we didn't talk to reporters or anything until the investigation on the assassination of Kennedy was complete. I personally feel that's what it was. So with that understanding, that
if at any point you feel that there is a particular item which is a question of national security or something like that, please consult with an attorney.
I will, but there's nothing that I can tell you. I'll tell you that right now. It would have anything to do with national security.
Okay. And just for the record, to clarify what the orders may have been, were these signed during who and who orders to sign? Were they orders?
I think it came through our chief of staff in our office. We were Military District of Washington, and came through our chief of staff. Who's a Colonel Holden? You know, he got it from wherever. That's the best I can remember. Mm-hmm. Okay, no problem. Let's go on from there. I hope I can help you.
I know. If it's not a labyrinth, it's at least a hall of mirrors. So with that, let's listen to the rest of episode 66 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. Who were the three men, the three pathologists that performed the forensics that night at Bethesda? I promised I would cover a little bit of the background for each, so here I go, but I am going to keep it brief. Commander James Humes, MD, who was principally responsible for the autopsy, was a mere 38 years old when the president passed. At 38, I am sure he was not the most experienced pathologist that could do the job, but maybe the most brilliant at that age? Hold that thought for a moment. He obtained a MD degree from Jefferson Medical College in 1948, and he completed his residency in pathology at the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in 1956. In 1960, Captain Humes became the chief of anatomic pathology at the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And I say anatomic pathology particularly, and I will explain the nuances of this in a minute. The following year, he became the director of the laboratories at the National Medical Center. In that capacity, he conducted an autopsy of President John F. Kennedy. J. Thornton Boswell was educated at the College of Medicine at The Ohio State University. He joined the United States Navy before taking pathology training at St. Albans Naval Hospital in New York. He was certified by the American Board of Pathology at the National Naval Medical School in 1957. He was later appointed chief of pathology there. Pierre-Antoine Finck studied at the University of Geneva Medical School. After graduating in 1948, he spent 2 years at the Institute of Pathology in Geneva before moving to the United States, where he continued his studies at the University of Tennessee Medical School. In 1955, Finck was drafted into the United States Army. He was sent to Germany, and he became a pathologist at the U.S. Army Hospital in Frankfurt. In 1959, Finck was sent to the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology in Washington. The following year, he was appointed chief of the Wound Ballistics Pathology Branch of the Institute. Of the three pathologists in question, Dr. Finck clearly had the most experience in the task that these three pathologists were about to undertake. For those of us that are not clinicians, I would like to explain some of the subtle differences when trying to decipher the qualifications of these three men. All three of these men were pathologists, well-trained pathologists, actually, but that wasn't the problem. In the medical profession, when describing doctors, there are two terms that you often hear. That is, of a specialist and a subspecialist. Your main doctor might be an internal medicine doctor, a generalist, but when he hears a heart during one of your routine exams, he might decide to send you to a specialist, say a cardiologist, who checks you out and decides that you need a procedure. Let's say the procedure is an ablation, which is a specialized procedure applied to the heart. One that is to be done by a type of cardiology doctor that does just that, performs ablations. He is said to be a subspecialist. Your main doctor, your internal medicine doctor who is a general practitioner, well-trained in many things, and likely even inherently understands the nature of the ablation procedure itself, but he or she would never perform it. They do not have the specialized training or qualifications, and most importantly, the experience to do so. Now, let's apply that concept to the world of pathology. First, what is pathology? Well, simply put, pathology is the study of the causes and the effects of disease or injury. The word pathology also refers to the study of disease in general, incorporating a wide range of biology research fields and medical practices. A physician practicing pathology is called a pathologist. As a field of general inquiry and research, pathology addresses components of disease, the causes, the mechanisms of disease, and development of disease. And these things are known as pathogenesis. It includes the study of the structural alterations of cells and the consequences of changes in those cells. In common medical practice, general pathology is mostly concerned with analyzing known clinical abnormalities, ones that are markers or precursors for both infectious and non-infectious disease. And these activities are conducted by experts in one of the two major specialties within pathology. The first specialty is anatomical pathology, and the second specialty is clinical pathology. I am going to try and make a simple breakdown here. Anatomical pathology is mainly concerned with the examination of organs and tissues. Clinical pathology is focused on the diagnosis of disease through a lab analysis of some sort involving bodily fluids or tissues. When you think laboratory, think clinical. When your blood is drawn and then reviewed, this is a clinical lab approach. There are many subspecialties here. For example, you've probably heard the terms cytopathology, hematopathology, histopathology. If you study anatomical pathology and get focused on kidneys, well, then you might be a subspecialist in renal pathology. Now that we understand the general definition of pathology and the breakdown of the two specialties and then some of the subspecialties, we can better understand an even more refined subspecialty, one that is known as forensic pathology. Forensic pathologists receive specialized training in determining the cause of death and other legally relevant information from the bodies of persons who died suddenly with no known medical condition, those who die from non-natural causes, as well as those dying as a result of homicide or other criminally suspicious deaths. Forensic pathologists will often testify in courts regarding their findings in cases or in deaths that are surrounded by dubious circumstances. Forensic pathologists often have special areas of interest, even within their own practice. A good example is gunshot wounds, or deaths due to drugs, or even things like sudden infant death syndrome, or SIDS. And there are so many others. You get the picture, though. This is a highly specialized subspecialty. So what does that mean for our evaluation? I mean, if you are going to perform the autopsy on the President of the United States who has just been murdered by a gunshot, you better be a well-trained forensic pathologist and a forensic pathologist that specializes in gunshot wounds, right? I mean, this is a really hard one to dispute, I think. Neither Dr. Humes or Dr. Boswell were forensic pathologists. And on top of that, they had even less experience with gunshot wounds, which is the reason that Dr. Pierre Fink was called in to assist them. By the start of the autopsy, Humes knew that he needed help. He called Fink. While Fink never gloved up, never physically laid a hand on the president, he would be the only one of the three with any extensive experience related to ballistic wounds. Little did he know that his testimony and assessments would later become critical in light of the credentials and experience that both Humes and Boswell did not possess. You know, there is no truly detailed blow-by-blow story of the autopsy that night. It started around 8, as we said, and it lasted 3 or 4 hours, with many routine things that go on, too gory to talk about here. And it got done around midnight. And then folks from the Gawler Funeral Home went to work on putting the president back together and doing what funeral homes do to make bodies presentable. Lieutenant Lipsey was there for that. It lasted until the wee hours of the morning, somewhere between 3 and 4 a.m., when they finally finished up with the president's body and then took him for the ride back to the White House, where a private viewing was then had by a small number of intimates led by Jackie Kennedy. In his later years, outside of his HSCA testimony, Lipsey would tell a bit of the story of that night. Here is one such interview he participated in, a TEDx talk conducted at Louisiana State University, where he does just that. And so let's listen to it here.
Richard, I'm so excited to share your experience with our TEDx audience today. So you had actually interacted with President Kennedy on a number of occasions. Is that correct?
I did, Stacy. I was very lucky when General Wheel moved from Fort Polk to Washington. He took me with him as his junior aide. So immediately after getting to Washington, the president and I, the general and I were introduced to President Kennedy. We actually went to the White House, went into the Oval Office. He allowed me to sit in his rocking chair while he and General Wheel talked. And so that was our first introduction to the president.
And you would provide him briefings?
We did. When we'd go to the White House, generally General Wheel would go to Andrews Air Force Base or the Blair House, wherever the people were from, the kings, queens, head of states, premiers, and he would bring them to the White House. In the meantime, I would go to the White House, take a briefing book to the president. The president was amazing. I could give him a book from 60, 80, 100 pages. He would skim through it, and within a minute or two, he would hand it back to me, and he could just tell me what was almost on any page. He was a speed reader. He had a photographic memory. He was a historian. He looked to the future. The guy was amazing. He had vision, but he was totally absorb any reading material immediately. And he was just a totally brilliant guy.
Now, General Will and you as his aide-de-camp were responsible for state funerals. Should either a past president or a sitting president die, which meant the minute that the bullets hit President Kennedy, you were in charge. So where were you when you got the news?
We had taken General Will to the office in the morning, and we had come back to his house at lunchtime and dropped him off, went to our BOQ, had lunch, came back to his house, and the driver and I were standing outside listening to the radio. And we heard the news, my God, the president's been shot. So I started running to the general's house, and immediately he came out of the back door. We ran into each other. Have you heard the news, he said to me. We jumped in the car, headed out to our office at Fort McNair. Before we left Fort Myer, a red phone rang. Now, remember, these are the days, not the days of cell phones. And this is 1963. And so the general picked up the phone, and it was Mrs. Lincoln, President Kennedy's assistant, telling us to come immediately to the White House. Well, we started to the White House, a lot of traffic. We got to the White House in a pretty timely fashion. But by then, it was known that the president was dead. There was chaos in the White House. There was literally nothing we could do. So we headed over to Fort McNair, to our office, where we had a book that thick of plans to start going through the plans for a state funeral.
So what was your role when the body is returned on Air Force One back to the Capitol?
We had been notified about mid-afternoon that the body would be returned to Washington about 6:30 p.m. So about 5 o'clock, we left Fort McNair and went to Andrews Air Force Base. And before we left, General Wheel reached in his drawer, pulled out two semi-automatic pistols, a 45, and he strapped one on me. And he said, now, when we get that body off the airplane, don't you leave it until they bury him. And that was my marching orders. So anyhow, we get to Andrews Air Force Base. The body's coming off the airplane. And, of course, the Secret Service and the FBI, they're all up there trying to grapple with the coffin to get it off the plane. And finally, they let our honor guard from the 3rd Infantry there at Fort Myer, Arlington Cemetery, they let them get the body, get it off the plane, put it in this squatty little gray Navy ambulance, which we were using for a hearse. And we got the body in there. Jackie got into the hearse and then started going to the Bethesda Naval Hospital.
And so were you in the ambulance or
were No, actually, what we did, we got the body, the casket, into mm-hmm. the ambulance. We put our car at the head of the procession and then let it start to leave. And General Wheel, myself, and the honor guard from the 3rd Infantry, and also a Marine guard, got on this old Chinook helicopter, the double-rotor helicopter, and we flew ahead of the procession okay. so we would be at the Bethesda Naval Hospital when the body arrived. General Wheel went to the front door to meet Jackie. I went around behind the hospital to the morgue with the honor guard so we would be there when the coffin got there so we could bring it into the autopsy room.
And so you were there for the entire autopsy?
Yes, I was. The autopsy lasted about 3 hours. We got the body out of the ambulance, brought it in, took the body, and actually it was myself and two technicians, lifted the body out of the coffin, put it on this cold steel table, took it out of the body bag, and then the first thing that happened was, of course, the Army and Navy photographers came in, took a lot of pictures. Then the X-ray machines came in, took a lot of X-rays. And then when they left, these two technicians and myself literally wiped the blood off the body and just laid the body out and prepared it for the autopsy. And I moved off, as the doctors and the others started to come in for the autopsy, which lasted 3 hours.
The movie Jackie portrays the First Lady as bursting into the autopsy room in chaos and lots of individuals running around. Was that the case?
Well, the movie Jackie nor the movie JFK, the Oliver Stone movie, neither one of them were very accurate. Actually, Jackie, when she got to the Bethesda Naval Hospital, as I said, General Wheel met her at the front door. They immediately went upstairs. You know, Jackie was very sophisticated, very attractive lady. She still had on this beautiful pink suit with the blood splattered on it, but she never came down out of the 17th floor. In the meantime, there was not a lot of people in the autopsy room. There were the three doctors, a couple of technicians, myself, and every now and then an FBI agent or a Secret Service agent would stick their head in. But no, it was not a three-ring circus like it showed in the movie.
So were you calling home to say, Mom, Dad, you're not going to believe what happened to me today?
Well, actually, Stacy, I was sworn to secrecy. About three-fourths of the way during the autopsy, a person for the State Department came in with a form, said, sign this. And it was a National Secrets Act form that said I couldn't say anything that I saw during the autopsy for 15 years under a penalty of $25,000 or 10 years in jail. So no, I couldn't say anything I saw. But at the end of the autopsy, when General Wheel and I were going to leave to go change in our dress uniforms, I did grab a payphone, call my parents, said, guess where I am? And they said, we saw you on TV. Where are you now? I said, I'm at the Bethesda Naval Hospital.
But that was all you could say.
That was all I could say.
Now, the autopsy is over, and what happens then with the body?
Okay, as soon as the autopsy was over, General Wheel and myself, we got in our automobile, drove back to, very fast, drove back to our quarters so we could change in our dress uniforms. We sent the driver to the White House. Jackie had called, and they had carefully laid out this beautiful dark suit, nice silk tie, white shirt, so on and so forth. Picked that up, came back and picked us up. We went back to the hospital. All of that only took about 40 minutes. And then while General Wheel went back upstairs with Jackie to complete planning the funeral. And by the way, she was very focused from the moment she got to that hospital until this moment. It was until we left hours later. She knew exactly what she wanted to happen during the funeral. But in the meantime, I sat there for another 3.5 hours. We unlocked the doors, let Gawler's funeral home in, and for 3.5 hours, I watched them prepare the president's body. You know, at the end of that, before we dressed him, to see the naked body, a perfectly fit president of the United States, not an ounce of fat on him, to see him lying there on this cold steel table. The man from Gawler's funeral home and another technician that was there and myself, before we dressed him, we just had to take a deep breath and say, my God, you know, I'd never seen a dead man, and here I am looking at a man I know so well, the President of the United States, dead, and I may be the last person to see him. We dressed him, and I helped the Gawler's funeral man lift him and put him in his casket, close the casket before we started our procession back to the White House.
And there was a mass held at the White House then?
Yes, we put the body back in the ambulance, the coffin. the new coffin. We went back to the White House, and slowly we went into the White House. We took the body, came in. I stood there at the entrance and sort of watched, oversaw things. As the coffin came in, then Jackie followed and came in. Then we went into the East Room. We put the casket on a catafalque, the same type of one that was used by Abraham Lincoln in Abraham Lincoln's funeral 98 years before. And the chandeliers were draped. A very somber scene. It was just myself, Jackie, Bobby Eunice Shriver, four or five members of the White House staff. We closed the doors and had a private mass for Jackie, about for the president, for about 15 minutes. Then Jackie asked us all to leave, and she and the priest stayed in the room for about 5-6 minutes, no more than that. And then they came out. And
I think you certainly have the expertise in terms of the firearms, and you actually saw the bullet wounds on the president. There are a lot of conspiracy theories. What's your opinion?
Well, I did. I watched the autopsy from a distance of about maybe 2 or 3 feet further than you or I sitting together on a little riser. So I could see right down on it from about 6 or 8 feet. And I could hear the doctors talking back and forth. And it was no question there were two bullets that entered the president from behind. And it came out of a six, because they retrieved the bullet fragment. And it came from a 6.5 Carcana Italian rifle, the same type of bullets that the shell casings were found on the sixth floor of the school book depository there in Dallas. So the doctors agreed. I could see it. There's no question Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone assassin, and the bullets did come from behind him and the rear. There were no other shots fired that day from the grassy knoll. And you know, there was a lot of imagination, a lot of people that saw and heard echoes, but definitely the shots were fired by Lee Harvey Oswald.
So all these many years later, what has stayed with you, or what are your thoughts about what was lost?
Wow, that's a really good question, Stacy. I guess the fact that, first of all, John Kennedy was such a brilliant man. As I said before, he was a great historian, but he had vision. He looked to the future. He wanted to know what the world was going to be like. He wanted to put a man on the moon. He wanted to tear down the Berlin Wall. He wanted peace in his life's lifetime. He was interested in what painters and writers and musicians had to, and philosophers. He was interested in what they had to say. I guess it's difficult to put it all together, but this was probably the most brilliant president in our lifetime, certainly in my lifetime, and I think in many generations. I can only imagine what the world would have been like if he would have lived. This truly was the end of Camelot.
Thank you for listening to episode 66 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.